I caught the measles when I was 8, and I was very ill. I thought you were going to die, my father told me once, and he was not a man prone to exaggeration. He told me about how he and my mother had dunked me in a tub of cold water one night, both of them at least half convinced the shock of it would stop my heart, but both of them completely convinced that I'd burn up before their eyes if they didn't do something. I had begun to speak in a loud, monotonously discursive voice about the bright figures I saw in the room. Angels come to bear me away, my terrified mother was sure. And the last time my father took my temperature before the cold plunge, he said that the mercury on the old Johnson & Johnson rectal thermometer had stood at 106 degrees. After that, he said, he didn't dare take it any more. I don't remember any bright figures, but I remember a strange period of time that was like being in a funhouse corridor where several different movies were showing at once. The world grew elastic, bulging in places where it had never bulged before, wavering in places where it had always been solid. People, most of them seeming impossibly tall, darted in and out of my room on scissoring, cartoonish legs. Their words all came out booming with instant echoes. Someone shook a pair of baby shoes in my face. I seem to remember my brother Siddy sticking his arm into his shirt and making repeated arm fart noises. Continuity broke down. Everything came in segments, weird wieners on a poison string. In the years between then and the summer I returned to Sarah Laughs, I had the usual sicknesses, infections, and insults to the body, but never anything like that feverish interlude when I was 8. I never expected to, believing, I suppose, that such experiences are unique to children, people with malaria, or maybe those suffering catastrophic mental breakdowns. But on the night of July 7th, in the morning of July 8th, I lived through a period of time remarkably like that childhood delirium. Dreaming, waking, moving, they were all one. I'll tell you as best I can, but nothing I say can convey the strangeness of that experience. It was as if I had found a secret passage hidden just beyond the wall of the world and went crawling along it. First there was music, not Dixieland because there were no horns, but like Dixieland, a primitive, reeling kind of bebop, 3 or 4 acoustic guitars, a harmonica, a stand-up bass, or maybe a pair. Behind all this was a hard, happy drumming that didn't sound like it was coming from a real drum. It sounded as if someone with a lot of percussive talent was whopping on a bunch of boxes. Then a woman's voice joined in, a high tenor voice, not quite mannish, roughing over the high notes. It was laughing and urgent and ominous all at the same time, and I knew at once that I was hearing Sarah Tidwell, who had never cut a record in her life. I was hearing Sarah Laughs, and man, she was rocking. You know, we're going back to Manderley. We're gonna dance on the Sanderley. I'm gonna sing with the Banderley. We're gonna ball all we can to leave. Ball me, baby, yeah. The basses, yes, there were two, broke out in a barnyard shuffle like the break in Elvis's version of Baby Let's Play House. And then there was a guitar solo, Son Tidwell playing that chicken scratch thing. Lights gleamed in the dark, and I thought of a song from the 50s, Claudine Clark singing Party Lights. And here they were, Japanese lanterns hung from the trees above the path of railroad tie steps leading from the house to the water. Party lights casting mystic circles of radiance in the dark, red, blue, and green. Behind me, Sarah was singing the bridge to her Manderley song, Mama Likes It Nasty, Mama Likes It Strong, Mama Likes to Party All Night Long. But it was fading. Sarah and the Red Top Boys had set up their bandstand in the driveway by the sound, about where George Footman had parked when he came to serve me with Max DeVore's subpoena. I was descending toward the lake through circles of radiance, past party lights surrounded by soft-winged moths. One had found its way inside a lamp, and it cast a monstrous, bat-like shadow against the ribbed paper. The flower boxes Joe had put beside the steps were full of night-blooming roses. In the light of the Japanese lanterns, they looked blue. Now the band was only a faint murmur. I could hear Sarah shouting out the lyric, laughing her way through it as though it were the funniest thing she'd ever heard, all that manderly, sanderly, canderly stuff. But I could no longer make out the individual words. Much clearer was the lap of the lake against the rocks at the foot of the steps, the hollow clunk of the canisters under the swimming float, and the cry of a loon drifting out of the darkness. Someone was standing on the street to my right, at the edge of the lake. I couldn't see his face, but I could see the brown sport coat and the T-shirt he was wearing beneath it. The lapels cut off some of the letters of the message, so it looked like this. Orma, Aun. I knew what it said anyway. In dreams, you almost always know, don't you? Normal sperm count. A village cafe yuck-it-up special if there ever was one. I was in the north bedroom dreaming all this, and here I woke up enough to know I was dreaming. Except it was like waking into another dream, because Bunter's bell was ringing madly, and there was someone standing in the hall. Mr. Normal Sperm Count? No, not him. The shadow shape falling on the door wasn't quite human. It was slumped, the arms indistinct. I sat up into the silver shaking of the bell, clutching a loose puddle of sheet against my naked waist, sure it was the shroud thing out there. The shroud thing had come out of its grave to get me. Please don't, I said in a dry and trembling voice. Please don't, please. The shadow on the door raised its arms. It ain't nothing but a bond dance, sugar, Sarah Tidwell's laughing, furious voice sang. It ain't nothing but a round and round. I laid back down and pulled the sheet over my face in a childish act of denial. And there I stood, on our little lick of beach, wearing just my undershorts. My feet were ankle deep in the water. It was warm the way the lake gets by midsummer. My dim shadow was cast two ways, in one direction by the scantling moon which rode low above the water, in another by the Japanese lantern with the moth caught inside it. The man who'd been standing on the path was gone, but he had left a plastic owl to mark his place. It stared at me with frozen, gold-ringed eyes. Hey, Irish! I looked out at the swimming float. Joe stood there. She must have just climbed out of the water because she was still dripping and her hair was plastered against her cheeks. She was wearing the two-piece swimsuit from the photo I'd found, gray with red piping. It's been a long time, Irish. What do you say? Say about what? I called back, although I knew. About this. She put her hands over her breasts and squeezed. Water ran out between her fingers and trickled across her knuckles. Come on, Irish, she said from beside and above me. Come on, you bastard, and let's go. I felt her strip down the sheet, pulling it easily out of my sleep-numbed fingers. I shut my eyes, but she took my hand and placed it between her legs. As I found that velvety seam and began to stroke it open, she began to rub the back of my neck with her fingers. You're not Joe, I said. Who are you? But no one was there to answer. I was in the woods. It was dark, and on the lake the loons were crying. I was walking the path to Joe's studio. It wasn't a dream. I could feel the cool air against my skin and the occasional bite of a rock into my bare sole or heel. A mosquito buzzed around my ear and I waved it away. I was wearing jockey shorts, and at every step they pulled against a huge and throbbing erection. What the hell is this? I asked as Joe's little barnboard studio loomed in the dark. I looked behind me and saw Sarah on her hill. Not the woman, but the house, a long lodge jutting toward the night-bound lake. What's happening to me? Everything's all right, Mike, Joe said. She was standing on the float, watching as I swam toward her. She put her hands behind her neck like a calendar model, lifting her breasts more fully into the damp halter. As in the photo, I could see her nipples poking out the cloth. I was swimming in my underpants and with the same huge erection. Everything's all right, Mike, Maddie said in the north bedroom, and I opened my eyes. She was sitting beside me on the bed, smooth and naked in the weak glow of the nightlight. Her hair was down, hanging to her shoulders. Her breasts were tiny, the size of teacups, but the nipples were large and distended. Between her legs, where my hand still lingered, was a powder puff of blonde hair, smooth as down. Her body was wrapped in shadows like moth wings, like rose petals. There was something desperately attractive about her as she sat there. She was like the prize you know you'll never win at the Kearney Shooting Gallery or the County Fair Ring Toss, the one they keep on the top shelf. She reached under the sheet and folded her fingers over the stretched material of my undershorts. "Everything's all right. This ain't nothing but a round and round," said the UFO voice as I climbed the steps to my wife's studio. I stooped, fished for the key from beneath the mat, and took it out. I climbed the ladder to the float, wet and dripping, preceded by my engorged sex. Is there anything, I wonder, so unintentionally comic as a sexually aroused man? Joe stood on the boards in her wet bathing suit. I pulled Maddie into bed with me. I opened the door to Joe's studio. All of these things happened at the same time, weaving in and out of each other like strands of some exotic rope or belt. The thing with Joe felt the most like a dream. The thing in the studio, me crossing the floor and looking down at my old green IBM, the least. Maddie in the north bedroom was somewhere in between. On the float, Joe said, "Do what you want." In the north bedroom, Maddie said, "Do what you want." In the studio, no one had to tell me anything. In there, I knew exactly what I wanted. On the float, I bent my head and put my mouth on one of Joe's breasts and sucked the cloth-covered nipple into my mouth. I tasted damp fabric and dank lake. She reached for me where I stuck out and I slapped her hand away. If she touched me, I would come at once. I sucked, drinking back trickles of cotton water, groping with my own hands, first caressing her ass and then yanking down the bottom half of her suit. I got it off her, and she dropped to her knees. I did too, finally getting rid of my wet, clinging underpants and tossing them on top of her bikini panty. We faced each other that way, me naked, her almost. "Who was the guy at the game?" I panted. "Who was he, Joe?" "No one in particular, Irish. Just another bag of bones." She laughed, then leaned back on her haunches and stared at me. Her navel was a tiny black cup. There was something queerly, attractively snake-like in her posture. "Everything down there is death," she said, and pressed her cold palms and white, pruny fingers to my cheeks. She turned my head and then bent it, so I was looking into the lake. Under the water, I saw decomposing bodies slipping by, pulled by some deep current. Their wet eyes stared. Their fish-nibbled noses gaped. Their tongues lolled between white lips like tendrils of waterweed. Some of the dead trailed pallid balloons of jellyfish guts. Some were little more than bone. Yet not even the sight of this floating charnel parade could divert me from what I wanted. I shrugged my head free of her hands, pushed her down on the boards, and finally cooled what was so hard and contentious, sinking it deep. Her moon-silvered eyes stared up at me, through me, and I saw that one pupil was larger than the other. That was how her eyes had looked on the TV monitor when I had identified her in the Derry County morgue. She was dead. My wife was dead, and I was fucking her corpse. Nor could even that realization stop me. "Who was he?" I cried at her, covering her cold flesh as it lay on the wet boards. "Who was he, Joe? For Christ's sake, tell me who he was." In the north bedroom, I pulled Maddie on top of me, relishing the feel of those small breasts against my chest and the length of her entwining legs. Then I rolled her over on the far side of the bed. I felt her hand reaching for me and slapped it away. If she touched me where she meant to touch me, I would come in an instant. "Spread your legs, hurry," I said, and she did. I closed my eyes, shutting out all other sensory input in favor of this. I pressed forward, then stopped. I made one little adjustment, pushing at my engorged penis with the side of my hand, then rolled my hips and slipped into her like a finger into a silk-lined glove. She looked up at me, wide-eyed, then put a hand on my cheek and turned my head. "Everything out there is death," she said, as if only explaining the obvious. In the window, I saw Fifth Avenue between 50th and 60th, all those trendy shops, Bijan and Bally, Tiffany and Bergdorf's, and Steuben Glass. And here came Harold Oblowski, northbound and swinging his pigskin briefcase, the one Joe and I had given him for Christmas the year before she died. Beside him, carrying a Brentano's bag by the handles, was the bountiful, beauteous Nola, his secretary. Except her bounty was gone. This was a grinning, yellow-jawed skeleton in a Donna Karan suit and alligator pumps. Scrawny, beringed bones gripped the bag handles instead of fingers. Harold's teeth jutted in his usual agent's grin, now extended to the point of obscenity. His favorite suit, the double-breasted charcoal from Paul Stewart, flapped on him like a sail in a fresh breeze. All around them, on both sides of the street, walked the living dead, mommy mummies leading baby corpses by the hands or wheeling them in expensive prams, zombie doormen, reanimated skateboarders. Here a tall black man with the last few strips of flesh hanging from his face like cured deer hide walked his skeleton Alsatian. The cab drivers were rotting to raga music. The faces looking down from the passing buses were skulls, each wearing its own version of Harold's grin. "Hey, how are you? How's the wife? How's the kids? Writing any good books lately?" The peanut vendors were putrefying, yet none of it could quench me. I was on fire. I slipped my hands under her buttocks, lifting her, biting at the sheet. The pattern I saw with no surprise was blue roses, until I pulled it free of the mattress to keep from biting her on the neck, the shoulder, the breasts, anywhere my teeth could reach. "Tell me who he was," I shouted at her. "You know, I know you do." My voice was so muffled by my mouthful of bed linen that I doubted if anyone but me could have understood it. "Tell me, you bitch." On the path between Joe's studio and the house, I stood in the dark with the typewriter in my arms and that dream-spanning erection quivering below its metal bulk, all that ready and nothing willing, except maybe for the night breeze. Then I became aware I was no longer alone. The shroud thing was behind me, called like the moths to the party lights. It laughed, a brazen, smoke-broken laugh that could belong to only one woman. I didn't see the hand that reached around my hip to grip me. The typewriter was in the way, but I didn't need to see it to know its color was brown. It squeezed, slowly tightening, the fingers wriggling. "What do you want to know, sugar?" she asked from behind me, still laughing, still teasing. "Do you really want to know at all? Do you want to know or do you want to feel?" "Oh, you're killing me," I cried. The typewriter, 30 or so pounds of IBM Selectric, was shaking back and forth in my arms. I could feel my muscles twanging like guitar strings. "Do you want to know who he was, sugar, that nasty man?" "Just do me, you bitch," I screamed. She laughed again, that harsh laughter that was almost like a cough, and squeezed me where the squeezing was best. "You hold still now," she said. "You hold still, pretty boy, unless you want me to take fright and yank this thing of yours right out by the..." I lost the rest as the whole world exploded in an orgasm so deep and strong that I thought it would simply tear me apart. I snapped my head back like a man being hung and ejaculated looking up at the stars. I screamed, I had to, and on the lake two loons screamed back. At the same time, I was on the float. Joe was gone, but I could faintly hear the sound of the band, Sarah and Sonny and the Red Top Boys tearing through Black Mountain Rag. I sat up, dazed and spent, fucked hollow. I couldn't see the path leading up to the house, but I could discern its switchback course by the Japanese lanterns. My underpants lay beside me in a little wet heap. I picked them up and started to put them on, only because I didn't want to swim back to shore with them in my hand. I stopped with them stretched between my knees, looking at my fingers. They were slimed with decaying flesh. Puffing out from beneath several of the nails were clumps of torn-out hair. Corpse hair. "Oh, Jesus," I moaned. The strength went out of me. I flopped into wetness. I was in the north wing bedroom. What I had landed in was hot, and at first I thought it was cum. The dim glow of the nightlight showed darker stuff, however. Maddie was gone, and the bed was full of blood. Lying in the middle of that soaking pool was something I at first glance took to be a clump of flesh or a piece of organ. I looked more closely and saw it was a stuffed animal, a black-furred object matted red with blood. I lay on my side looking at it, wanting to bolt out of the bed and flee from the room, but unable to do it. My muscles were in a dead swoon. Who had I really been having sex with in this bed? And what had I done to her? In God's name, what? "I don't believe these lies," I heard myself say. And as though it were an incantation, I was slapped back together. That isn't exactly what happened, but it's the only way of saying that seems to come close to whatever did. There were three of me, one on the float, one in the north bedroom, one on the path, and each one felt that hard slap as if the wind had grown a fist. There was rushing blackness, and in it the steady silver shaking of Bunter's bell. Then it faded, and I faded with it. For a little while, I was nowhere at all. I came back to the casual chatter of birds on summer vacation and to that peculiar red darkness that means the sun is shining through your closed eyelids. My neck was stiff, my head was canted at a weird angle, my legs were folded awkwardly beneath me, and I was hot. I lifted my head with a wince, knowing even as I opened my eyes that I was no longer in bed, no longer on the swimming float, no longer on the path between the house and the studio. It was floorboards under me, hard and uncompromising. The light was dazzling. I squinched my eyes closed again and groaned like a man with a hangover. I eased them back open behind my cupped hands, gave them time to adjust, then cautiously uncovered them, sat all the way up, and looked around. I was in the upstairs hall, lying under the broken air conditioner. Mrs. Meserve's note still hung from it. Sitting outside my office door was the green IBM with a piece of paper rolled into it. I looked down at my feet and saw that they were dirty. Pine needles were stuck to my soles and one toe was scratched. I got up, staggered a little, my right leg had gone to sleep, then braced a hand against the wall and stood steady. I looked down at myself. I was wearing the jockeys I'd gone to bed in, and I didn't look as if I'd had an accident in them. I pulled out the waistband and peeked inside. My cock looked as it usually did, small, soft, curled up asleep in its thatch of hair. If Noonan's folly had been adventuring in the night, there was no sign of it now. "It sure felt like an adventure," I croaked. I armed sweat off my forehead. It was stifling up here. Not the kind I ever read about in the Hardy Boys, though. Then I remembered the blood-soaked sheet in the north bedroom and the stuffed animal lying on its side in the middle of it. There was no sense of relief attached to the memory, that thank God it was only a dream feeling you get after a particularly nasty nightmare. It felt as real as any of the things I'd experienced in my measles fever delirium. And all those things had been real, just distorted by my overheated brains. I staggered to the stairs and limped down them, holding tight to the banister in case my tingling leg should buckle. At the foot, I looked dazedly around the living room, as if seeing it for the first time, and then limped down the north wing corridor. The bedroom door was ajar, and for a moment I couldn't bring myself to push it all the way open and go in. I was very badly scared, and my mind kept trying to replay an old episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the one about the man who strangled his wife during an alcoholic blackout. He spent the whole half hour looking for her, and finally found her in the pantry, bloated and open-eyed. Kyra DeVore was the only kid of stuffed animal age I'd met recently, but she had been sleeping peacefully under her cabbage rose coverlet when I left her mother and headed home. It was stupid to think I had driven all the way back to Wasp Hill Road, probably wearing nothing but my jockeys, that I had... What? Raped the woman? Brought the child here? In my sleep? I got the typewriter in my sleep, didn't I? It's sitting right upstairs in the goddamn hallway. Big difference between going 30 yards through the woods and 5 miles down the road to... I wasn't going to stand out here listening to those quarreling voices in my head. If I wasn't crazy, and I didn't think I was, listening to those contentious assholes would probably send me there, and by the express. I reached out and pushed the bedroom door open. For a moment, I actually saw a spreading octopus pattern of blood soaking into the sheet. That's how real and focused my terror was. Then I closed my eyes tight, opened them, and looked again. The sheets were rumpled, the bottom one mostly pulled free. I could see the quilted satin hide of the mattress. One pillow lay on the far edge of the bed, the other was scrunched down at the foot. The throw rug, a piece of Joe's work, was askew, and my water glass lay overturned on the night table. The bedroom looked as if it might have been the site of a brawl or an orgy, but not a murder. There was no blood and no little stuffed animal with black fur. I dropped to my knees and looked under the bed. Nothing there, not even dust kitties, thanks to Brenda Meserve. I looked at the ground sheet again, first passing a hand over its rumpled topography, then pulling it back down and resecuring the elasticized corners. Great invention, those sheets. If women gave out the Medal of Freedom instead of a bunch of white politicians who never made a bed or washed a load of clothes in their lives, the guy who thought up fitted sheets would undoubtedly have gotten a piece of that tin by now, in a rose garden ceremony. With the sheet pulled taut, I looked again. No blood, not a single drop. There was no stiffening patch of semen either. The former I hadn't really expected, or so I was already telling myself. But what about the latter? At the very least, I'd had the world's most creative wet dream, a triptych in which I had screwed two women and gotten a hand job from a third, all at the same time. I thought I had that morning-after feeling, too, the one you get when the previous night's sex has been of the head-busting variety. But if there had been fireworks, where was the burnt gunpowder? In Joe's studio, most likely, I told the empty, sunny room. Or on the path between here and there. Just be glad you didn't leave it in Maddie DeVore, bucko. An affair with a post-adolescent widow you don't need. A part of me disagreed. A part of me thought Maddie DeVore was exactly what I did need. But I hadn't had sex with her last night, any more than I had had sex with my dead wife out on the swimming float or gotten a hand job from Sarah Tidwell. Now that I saw I hadn't killed a nice little kid either, my thoughts turned back to the typewriter. Why had I gotten it? Why bother? Oh, man, what a silly question. My wife might have been keeping secrets from me, maybe even having an affair. There might be ghosts in the house. There might be a rich old man half a mile south who wanted to put a sharp stick into me and then break it off. There might be a few toys in my own humble attic, for that matter. But as I stood there in a bright shaft of sunlight, looking at my shadow on the far wall, only one thought seemed to matter. I had gone out to my wife's studio and gotten my old typewriter, and there was only one reason to do something like that. I went into the bathroom, wanting to get rid of the sweat on my body and the dirt off my feet before doing anything else. I reached for the shower handle, then stopped. The tub was full of water. Either I had for some reason filled it during my sleepwalk, or something else had. I reached for the drain lever, then stopped again, remembering that moment on the shoulder of Route 68 when my mouth had filled up with the taste of cold water. I realized I was waiting for it to happen again. When it didn't, I opened the bathtub drain to let out the standing water and started the shower. I could have brought the Selectric downstairs, perhaps even lugged it out onto the deck where there was a little breeze coming over the surface of the lake, but I didn't. I had brought it all the way to the door of my office, and my office was where I'd work, if I could work. I'd work in there even if the temperature beneath the roof peak built to 120 degrees, which by 3 in the afternoon it just might. The paper rolled into the machine was an old pink carbon receipt from Click, the photo shop in Castle Rock where Joe had bought her supplies when we were down here. I'd put it in so that the blank side faced the courier type ball. On it, I had typed the names of my little harem, as if I had tried in some struggling way to report on my three-faceted dream even while it was going on. Joe, Sarah, Maddie. Joe, Sarah, Maddie. Maddie, Maddie. Sarah, Sarah. Joe, Joanna. Sarah, Joe. Maddie, Sarah, Joe. Below this, in lowercase, normal sperm count. Sperm norm. All's rosy. I opened the office door, carried the typewriter in, and put it in its old place beneath the poster of Richard Nixon. I pulled the pink slip out of the roller, balled it up, and tossed it into the wastebasket. Then I picked up the Selectric's plug and stuck it in the baseboard socket. My heart was beating hard and fast, the way it had when I was 13 and climbing the ladder to the high board at the Y pool. I had climbed that ladder 3 times when I was 12 and then slunk back down it again. Once I turned 13, there could be no chickening out. I really had to do it. I thought I'd seen a fan hiding in the far corner of the closet behind the box marked Gadgets. I started in that direction, then turned around again with a ragged little laugh. I'd had moments of confidence before, hadn't I? Yes. And then the iron bands had clamped around my chest. It would be stupid to get out the fan and then discover I had no business in this room after all. "Take it easy," I said. "Take it easy." But I couldn't, no more than that narrow-chested boy in the ridiculous purple bathing suit had been able to take it easy when he walked to the end of the diving board, the pool so green below him, the upraised faces of the boys and girls in it so small, so small. I bent to one of the drawers on the right side of the desk and pulled so hard it came all the way out. I got my bare foot out of its landing zone just in time and barked a gust of loud, humorless laughter. There was half a ream of paper in the drawer. The edges had that faintly crispy look paper gets when it's been sitting for a long time. I no more than saw it before remembering I had brought my own supply, stuff a good deal fresher than this. I left it where it was and put the drawer back in its hole. It took several tries to get it on its tracks. My hands were shaking. At last I sat down in my desk chair, hearing the same old creaks as it took my weight and the same old rumble of the casters as I rolled it forward, snugging my legs into the knee hole. Then I sat facing the keyboard, sweating hard, still remembering the high board at the Y, how springy it had been under my bare feet as I walked its length, remembering the echoing quality of the voices below me, remembering the smell of chlorine and the steady low throb of the air exchangers, fwung, 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 as if the water had its own secret heartbeat. I had stood at the end of the board wondering, and not for the first time, if you could be paralyzed if you hit the water wrong. Probably not, but you could die of fear. There were documented cases of that in Ripley's Believe It or Not, which served me as science between the ages of 8 and 14. "Go on," Joe's voice cried. My version of her voice was usually calm and collected. This time it was shrill. "Stop dithering and go on." I reached for the IBM's rocker switch, now remembering the day I had dropped my Word 6 program into the PowerBook's trash. "Goodbye, old pal," I had thought. "Please let this work," I said. "Please." I lowered my hand and flicked the switch. The machine came on. The courier ball did a preliminary twirl, like a ballet dancer standing in the wings waiting to go on. I picked up a piece of paper, saw my sweaty fingers were leaving marks and didn't care. I rolled it into the machine, centered it, then wrote Chapter 1 and waited for the storm to break.